Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 686.DE2407, certificate number 25468, Kids on Milk Cartons.
Pictures of missing children appeared everywhere, from milk cartons to pizza boxes, grocery bags, and envelopes. Their faces underneath the troubling question, have you seen me?
Do you have memories of, what's your first memory of strangers? As an evil force, were you raised in America and in America where kids were being indoctrinated against strangers?
Do you really want to go here?
Well, I mean, does it end with you in a van? I don't.
No, my first up until this event, none of us locked our doors. No one cared where kids were. And then
people preferred not to know where their
kids
were.
They really
did. People were slightly drunk, 12 to 15 hours a day. You don't want to be thinking about your kids.
The hours between 9 a.m. and 8 p.m. are mama's cigarette smoking hours. Get out of the house and don't come back.
We've got guiding light and cigarettes.
And then a man in a Volkswagen at Lake Sammamish was reported to have asked a teenage girl for help putting his boat on the back of the car, and the girl disappeared.
This is the local stranger, a Lake Sammamish man in a Volkswagen.
And it was Ted Bundy.
Oh, well.
And we didn't know it was Ted Bundy, but there was this, like, a teenage girl got into a car with a man and disappeared. And then it happened again.
You have to imagine a world where this had not occurred to people.
No.
You know? If you've been raised in a post-Bundy, post-milk carton world, post-stranger danger, you can't imagine this.
And none of us could imagine it. And then somewhere around, I have a very distinct memory of driving, you know, the road to the 520 bridge, the turn there that goes under Harvard.
Yeah. This is good content for our non-Capitol Hill listeners.
Well, the side of that hill was overgrown brush. And the Green River Killer started, well, I guess that was early 80s. Anyway, the concept that you could find a body had never happened either. Like, you know, other than whatever, truckers or, but you know, the idea that there was a killer and that they were hiding bodies. And I remember watching a team of volunteers going through the brush and saying, what are all those people doing on the hillside? And my mom said, oh, they're searching for bodies, like teenagers.
And are you young enough at this point that changes how you were parented?
No, my parents still, well, it just changed the whole energy. Up
sure,
here,
but where? But did it affect you? I mean, were you getting the sit down talks? Because I also grew up here, and I got the sit down talks.
My sister was up at the bus stop on Dayton and 183rd.
Yeah,
how's this for content?
Yeah, who here is from Innis Arden? Anybody?
Dayton and 183rd. She was at the bus stop, and a man pulled up in a car and told her to get in. and she was six, and we had already had the talk, and she ran.
She remembered.
She did. And she, and it was just right a block from our house, and she ran to, and I was, she was up at the bus stop. I was on my way to meet her. And then I and my, my little band of lost boys, you know, with our homemade bows and arrows, all ran up there and were like, gonna fight this guy.
But the Ennis Arden killer was gone.
And I think I still, I, for years after, whenever I would go by that bus stop, I would have that, that visual of my sister in her little yellow dress being accosted by a man.
We were the first generation to be given very specific rules, like incredibly specific scenarios. Now you're going to be at home and somebody's going to knock on the door and they're going to say they're here to read a meter. And not only do you not let them in, you don't say your parents aren't here.
Right.
And, you know, somebody's going to come try to pick you up at school. I remember my mom telling somebody, and they're going to say that I gave permission to pick you up, but I didn't. So you're going to ask them what the secret safe word is.
This has to sound crazy to anyone younger than us, because they're like, yeah, this is just,
of course,
what it's like to,
what do you want to get in the car if they don't know the secret word?
But what, when, because I was already the time, by the time of the secret safe word stuff, I think everybody thought I was already too old to not.
Too old to kidnap, like a lot of them had.
Well, or too old not to know to get into a car with somebody that was telling me that they were a friend of my dad's. You know?
He will pick a younger, juicier kid.
But I definitely remember my sister hearing this, and it was all new, brand new. The idea that strangers were unsafe.
They're going to have candy, John.
Strangers are the ones that are supposed to help you when you get lost in the mall. Strangers are your fellow Americans who are.
That was how the previous generation was raised. Yeah. It takes a village, and you just need to find a trusted adult.
Yeah, that famous boomer phrase, it takes a village.
The boomers were all about communal good, famously. That's why they all moved to their little tiny suburbs and their big lawns.
this is an age difference between you and me. Yeah, this, and was this true also in Korea? Were you kind of a military?
I mean, we're living in some apartment complex. I don't know if my parents had a good sense of what the risks are, but by then everybody had been trained by the media to assume the worst.
Yeah, right.
And better safe than sorry, of course. I mean, you don't want your kids to get. You don't want all six of your kids to get kidnapped because you chose an insufficient, because you didn't choose a safe word with a number and a special character in it for the after school pickup.
I've thought about this so much because I'm a father of a daughter.
It's newly relevant now. As the father of a daughter,
as the father of a daughter, Ken.
Let's hear your definitive ally take.
Well, I live a mile from her mother, mm-hmm. and it's a mile through a safe subdivision in a suburb. But every time she leaves to make that trip, I've trained myself to not be
what if,
yeah, to not what if, but the what if is in the back of your head all the time. So she and I have spent several years talking about situational awareness, talking about, you know, never let yourself get caught between a rock and a hard place. If you like, always be aware of cars on the street and which houses are closest that you can get to. I mean, all this stuff, and we've always gamified it so it's like a secret agent thing, but. Like, I don't let her walk with headphones on.
I mean, cars are the real threat, you know, especially this kind of sidewalk-free neighborhood.
But I see people with headphones on walking at night, and I always am like, that's just bad. That's just bad ops.
Do you feel like it did anything to your brain to grow up in this world of the specter of constant threat that adults were always scaring you with?
Yeah. And I think it really does something to the kids' brains. But
that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I
how did it change your childhood?
Well, just think of how different the world is now than it was for us. I mean,
well, the result is, you know, kids who don't, as you say, don't have as wide a radius to explore.
My daughter has eaten a negligible number of worms, and by her age, I had eaten hundreds of worms.
This is why she's going to get some crippling gluten allergy. She's going to get celiac because she didn't have enough grams of worms per day.
The number of neighborhood bullies that held me down in a sticker bush. It's an uncountable number, and she's never been held in a sticker bush by a bully. I can't even name all the bullies.
I like how disappointed you are. My daughter, I'm sorry about this. Is a very sore subject to me. Nobody holds her down in a sticker bush. I'm sure I was shaped by this in some way, but honestly, a lot of my memories were about how goofy the whole thing seemed. I had cousins who were always listening to this cassette tape of the Safety Kids. The Safety Kids would, you know, I'm sure it was some free government giveaway, singing, you know, chipper songs about how no, you shouldn't let anybody touch you in your bathing suit area. And
it was funny.
Stay outside of my line or I'll tell on you. And I'll tell on you. I mean, it wasn't designed to be funny. It was designed to be catchy.
Yeah.
But to us, we were like, what is this goofy stuff? Just because it seemed so, you know, shrill and weird. And but that was the climate, you know. No parent wanted to not be the one to teach best practices. And we had been assured by nonprofits and by our municipalities and states and the federal government that this was what good parenting was.
I mean, Bundy happened when I was six. So I kind of did grow up in a post-Bundy Northwest, yeah. Right? And this wasn't a national thing yet, but it was very much, for whatever reason, we're so ahead of the curve with serial killing up here.
Well, you know, I didn't think about this when I was putting this together because, you know, in the Northwest, maybe this was actually a more real threat. You know, yeah. We did have some pretty high-profile guys collecting scores.
But they weren't kidnapping kids. You know, they were kidnapping, right.
And that's the thing about child kidnapping. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children will release statistics scaring parents with the fact that 2,300 American kids go missing every day.
Every day,
2,300 American kids go missing every day. That's 800,000 kids a year. No, and if you have, I mean, and you're laughing already, but if you're the average scared American parent with no sense of numeracy, you're like, oh no, 800,000 kids a year. Why is no one, why is this not driving all domestic and foreign policy? Every decision I make.
Like 800,000 kids.
You know, you leave Orange Julius at the mall and the food court's like, wait, are there six fewer kids than there were when I walked in?
Oh, I love statistics.
So these numbers, I mean, there are years where those are defensible interpretations of the numbers. But I think it's well understood now.
How many of those are being kidnapped by their dads?
That's the problem. That's exactly the problem. First, 99% of them are found quickly and they were just eating bugs in a neighbor's basement or something.
Yeah, highly recommended.
Right. Or you know, whatever. They were out back and they didn't come back to the playground when called. This happened once when my younger kid was little. Mindy freaked out because we couldn't find the group of friends at the playground. They were right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're yelling and yelling and yelling. And finally, it turns out they're just sitting in a bush having a tea party.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what they were doing.
Wow. You also live in a cynical post-Bundy world.
In my family, the famous story, my mom was on the phone and she had been mean to me already that day. And I wrote a letter, which we still have, you know, I'm running away forever. I am gone and not coming back was the final sentence. And I ran away and I went all the way from 183rd all the way to the QFC in Innisfarden.
Wow.
Walked, you know, on my bike, walked around the store mad, sure that there were already helicopters out searching for me, rode around, you know, went to the 7-Eleven and got a Slurpee and finally was like, I'm going to go back and watch the rescue effort. You know, I'm going to Tom Sawyer this.
It's like 45 minutes later.
Go to my own funeral, hide in the bushes. And I snuck, you know, all the way back into the yard and no hullabaloo at all. I got back in the house and she was still on the phone.
Kids are small. Kids are always wandering off. 99% of this, you know, 800,000 a year, you know, they are immediately found. And as you say, the other 98% of them are either just runaways or, as you say, a non-custodial parent, typically a father who doesn't like the custody arrangement or whatever it is.
Right.
And a fight with a spouse or an ex-spouse turns into a police report.
So how many legit, like, missing kids are there?
Let's look at the most recent numbers from the FBI. In 2019, when there were 75 million children in America, a lot of kids, the FBI says, depending on how you count, no more than between 52 and 306. It's oddly specific given the margin of error.
Mm-hmm.
It's not 51 and it's not 307. Between 52 and 306 kids in America were kidnapped by non-family. And a 2016 UC Irvine study looking at what is the risk of a child or teen being abducted and not returned, says that every year your child has a 0.00007% chance.
Jeez.
So it's of every 1.4 million kids, one every year is actually going to get kidnapped by not a dad or a stepdad.
And how many of those kidnappers are family, friends, or people they know?
Yeah, and many of those are acquaintances. Like, the stranger is even rarer than those, because this is now split between canonical guy in a windowless van and just, you know, weird neighbor.
Creepy uncle.
Yeah. The funny thing is, I remember my mom telling us when she gave us whatever the secret word for pickup, I think it was like Superman or something. We decided on a superhero. She said, you know, if it's just me, obviously I don't have to give the secret word. But then she said, and if it's anybody from church, that's fine. And I feel like that's a very blinkered 1970s view of who to trust.
Exactly.
Yeah, here's a random group of 100 people, but you worship with them. So,
yeah.
Probably, right?
Yeah, there's never an instance where a minister or a youth pastor.
Luckily, there has not been a single case in the news of any ecclesiastical person doing anything untoward to kids. So statistically, what the UC Irvine says is your odds are effectively zero. Like,
right.
if you were an actuary, 0.00007% would be, this is de minimis. This does not exist.
First of all, I love the word de minimis.
Let's say that more.
Thank you so much for giving me that today.
This way to reduce people.
But, okay, so...
And it's getting better, by the way, because we know that, right, that despite popular perception... Both violent and property crime have been cut in half since the early 90s.
Yeah.
So the risk is lower now than it ever was.
So what am I supposed to think about? I mean, because I'm also like not a particularly helicopter dad, but as you're saying this, I'm thinking about the U-Haul boxes of anxiety I have stored in the basement about my daughter being kidnapped. What am I supposed to do with all that, what apparently misplaced fear.
Maybe just redirect it into like web searching for Ukraine troop movements.
Yeah. How about climate change? What if I just put it all in my climate change?
Load it all into climate change. I mean, that's an interesting question. The emotional investment of parenting is just so intense in your lower brain that maybe statistics are not going to convince people.
How much of that low number is a product of all of us being hyper paranoid?
That's the question. Like, that's what people will often say. Because these, you know, there are today anti-helicopter parenting advocates, free range parents. Yeah. You know, like our kids, our generation turned out better because we got to bike around and eat worms.
But doesn't that feel like one of these Generation X Facebook memes where it's like, yeah, okay.
The reply is often, well, yeah, of course our kids are safer because we locked them down. But I think the problem with that is that the crime numbers have gone down with adults as well. Yeah. So it's not like the world got safer for kids just because we taught them all the secret school pickup password.
Okay. De minimis. A de minimis chance. Am I using that correctly?
I think so.
A de minimis.
It's adjectival.
A de minimis chance of
I just saw your kid upstairs like 20 minutes ago.
Not kidnapped, presumably.
Not kidnapped at the time. Reading a book about Victorian fashion paper dolls, I think.
That was the one. My child.
If we go up now, like, will she be one of the 800,000 kids that'll disappear this year? I bet not. I bet she's still right there.
Well, especially since, we've talked about it so much that she kind of is looking forward to being able to kick a grown man in the peanuts.
I thought you were going to say, well, yeah, I guess she's looking forward to being kidnapped.
There's one chance you're going to have in life to really nail somebody, and it's this. If a stranger touches you in public, you can kick him as hard as you want.
It's your big chance to take down the patriarchy. Nobody's going to stick up for that guy.
You are not allowed to do it in so many other instances.
Even the internet will not say, let's not ruin this guy's promising school career. But yeah, as you say, like, maybe numbers are not going to convince. I mean, we're still thinking the same way about this decades later, even though we have the statistics. But I think it's because stories are just more convincing to people than numbers. And you've got the stories, you know, the creepy guy that leered at your sister on Dayton. And everybody knows. I mean, maybe the Northwest is the exception because we actually did have Ted Bundy and the Green River Killer, you know, like,
right.
Teens probably shouldn't have been hanging out in parking lots at night.
Right. But I'm really kind of swamped with emotion right now, trying to figure out, knowing this, am I less likely to worry about her walking that mile and a half?
You should feel freed.
I know, but I'm not sure. The problem, I'm so in this cult.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, plus the problem with a near zero probability is...
It's not zero.
Yeah, when you're on a plane and you're like, this is so much safer than driving, but still, you know, then you hit turbulence and you're like, boy, there's really nothing under me right now.
But statistically, driving her that mile and a half is more dangerous to her.
That's well, I think the most dangerous thing, like the thing that really does kill kids and is probably on the
pesticides.
Rise. Hurricanes. No, is car accidents. Oh, you know, sure. American cars are getting bigger. Sight lines are worse.
People are really bad at driving.
People are antisocial now after COVID. And I think, yeah, car accidents, pedestrian accidents are actually on the rise because they're making the car safer for the driver at the expense of the whoever's under the wheels.
Well, especially now that cars don't make any sound.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
really great.
I can sneak up. I run over so many kids in my electric vehicle.
Yeah, your car goes...
I think that's federally mandated. Like they have to add a little weird hum because otherwise you'll just run over too many old ladies in the
It's not the parking a very loud lot. Hum. Your car makes more, the tires make more noise than any other.
It's
thing.
True. You realize how much, I'm on the freeway and I realize this is still kind of loud. The tires at high speed, the tires are making much more noise in your car than the engine probably.
Yeah.
Or at least you're closer to them. So I guess by the numbers, that's what you want to teach your kid. Like, please, please, please look both ways. Always crossing the crosswalk. But, you know, at some point somebody's going to offer you a Jolly Rancher, but that will have been laced with the following things. I mean,
right.
That's the fantasy. But these stories are powerful. So a very small number of them were enough to change the course of history. You mentioned the Northwest cases, but nationwide, I think the highest profile two were two very sad cases of six-year-old boys. In 1979, Eitan Peetz's parents send him off to school. They live on Prince Street in Soho.
In New York.
Lower East Side of Manhattan. And this is the first time he's ever walked by himself.
God.
And he's very excited. I know none of these are not great. He's very excited about it. He's going to walk the two blocks to the school bus. And his worried mom stands on the fire escape and watches him head off in the right direction. And there's going to be, you know, other moms are at the bus stop. So this is the perfect kind of test case. And he never makes it to the bus stop. You know, there's a, at the end of the day, he doesn't come home from school. And that's the first time the parents realize he's not at the school and the school realizes he's not at home. And that's when, you know, the manhunt begins. Eitan's dad is a photographer, which means there are tons of current and winsome photographs of this like photogenic young kid. And they are everywhere in New York, stapled to telephone poles and they're on TV and they're projected on the big Times Square screens. You know, this becomes a big story because it's got all the, you know, besides all the heartstrings of a worried parent, it's got just the mystery of, it's almost a Judge Crater kind of thing. There was just one block. What could have happened?
Yeah.
How did he disappear off the map? The other case, 2 years later in 1981, a six-year-old named Adam Walsh gets taken to the mall by his mom. She's going to go to Sears. We should probably explain that people...
Went to Sears.
His mom needs a lamp. And back then, if you needed a lamp, you had to walk into a Sears.
I remember this kid.
Yeah, this was a big deal. He is distracted immediately by the real villain of our story, an Atari 2600.
Oh.
Some boys are at the entrance playing at the new video game display, and he's immediately distracted, and his mom says, okay, I'll go get the lamp. You watch the video gaming. She gets the lamp and comes back, only to find that no kids are now in front of the game of Air Sea Battle or Pac-Man or whatever it was. And she asks the security guard, who's right there, and he's like, yeah, the older kids started scuffling over who had the next turn at the joystick, and I kicked them all out. And the mom said, well, what about the much littler? What about the six-year-old that was with them? And he was like, and Adam is just gone. Like, it's suspected that he, you know, being told to leave by a trusted adult.
Right.
In uniform, no less, you know, because one thing all American children learn, always... The cops are no problem.
Trust the police.
You know, walks out of some unfamiliar exit of the Sears or of the mall. And
following these boys, probably.
Yeah, and suddenly finds himself on some curb. He doesn't know where he is. And at that point, question mark, question mark, question mark. Many decades later, it comes out that Jeffrey Dahmer was actually living in Miami Beach at the time. And Dahmer swears up and down that he had nothing. And there's actually somebody says, I think, that Dahmer confessed to the Walsh kidnapping.
Really?
But he always...
His modus operandi was not little children.
No. And he was not shy about his abominations. Right. You know, he's a guy who's like, well, of course I ate them with a, you know, like they were so delicious.
With a Shiraz.
Yeah, exactly. Fava beans. But the believers will say, well, of course he's not, this guy's going to serve a long prison term. The last thing he's going to do is confess to his pedophilia phase. But the Adam Walsh case became huge. And this is kind of the case of all of the, what happens in a department store, all the urban legends you heard. I heard they grabbed a little girl and dragged her into the men's room and shaved her head so she looked like a boy and changed her clothes and walked her out right under her mom's nose. I've
never heard that one, but that's terrible.
Oh, you didn't get raised with all of these?
No.
Oh, man. Like, I can't, you know, I think of it in every box store, even if I'm not with my kids.
What, this is 82? I mean, I was already
81.
I was already 13.
You probably had two kids. You should have been terrified.
By time. I was selling drugs in those grocery stores.
Yeah, you knew where the security guards were. So this actually becomes a TV movie, Adam, you know. So Daniel Travanti of Hill Street Blues playing, because the parents were very critical of, the investigation I think had been botched at every level, at the enforcement, you know, at the mall for sure, at the law enforcement level later, maybe at the prosecutorial level, you know, they were very skeptical of the whole system. So you could watch a crusading Daniel Travanti from Hill Street Blues and JoBeth Williams from Poltergeist bemoaning their missing son.
I didn't see the television spectacular, but I remember the hype, the hoopla.
Yeah.
And I think at that age was probably like, why is everybody paying attention to this kid? Nobody pays attention to me.
That's your take. That's your take on child kidnapping.
Well, yeah, sure. These kids are gone, but I'm a latchkey kid over here.
Something like 35 million Americans watched this TV movie because it was a different time and not a lot going on. Yeah. I mean, those are big, like water cooler numbers. And what they did at the end of the show is they would show, every time this aired on whatever network it was, they would put up photos at the end of the show like, hey, do you recognize these
missing kids?
These kids? And apparently from various rebroadcasts, 13 of those missing kids were found. One of them was no less than Busy Bone, who would become the youngest member of Bone Thugs and Harmony. Future rapper Busy Bone had been, abducted with his sisters by his abusive stepfather, and so, you know, and subjected to, you know, years of just misery and I think sexual assault, and his birth father's looking for him everywhere. And it was actually an airing of this TV movie that brought Busy home and got him out of that terrible situation. But this leads to some furor, a national furor starts to spread, and it reaches, obviously it's a political winner. So it reaches DC and particularly the Reagan administration very quickly. You can see the appeal to a law and order, tough on crime, sheriff kind of candidate like Ronald Reagan in creating a scary other that's out there threatening your good American families.
I was just thinking about this the other day, that at some point along the way, I don't think this was true in the 60s, but at some point along the way, like the right started to equate liberalism with degeneracy in a sort of like Third Reich-y way.
Well, I was about to say, like, that starts with Goering, right?
Right.
I mean,
but like in the U.S., you know, I guess beatniks or whatever, but nobody said like, oh, beatniks molesters.
Are, yeah, exactly.
But the idea, yeah, that there were missing kids and...
Pedophilia is immediately the trump card, right?
Yeah,
like, if that's the threat, of course you'll do anything, you know? Of course you'll change systems, give up liberties, vote in weirdos, you know, whatever it takes, because kids are getting molested.
Oh, it was Manson. That's what it was.
Yeah.
To equate hippies with creeps started with Manson.
I mean, the hippies already were creeps. I mean Manson just... we're gonna hear about
we're gonna this. Hear from the hippie lobby. Ken Jennings is anti-hippie.
Hey man, like the hippies are gonna be too chill to write us emails, I think, or too confused.
Hey man.
So in 1983, Reagan announces that May 25th, which I think is the anniversary of Adam's disappearance or of his birthday. I think that becomes National Missing Children's Day. So it's on the calendar every year, this awareness that kids are leaving and then they're gone and we need to remember them. We need to find them. We need to safeguard our kids.
I was at the end of my freshman year of high school and I do remember.
You're
was,
safe.
Well, this was the era of MAD. This was the era of parents' music resource, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, this was just the beginning of that time where it
cracking
was like,
down.
Our kids.
Yeah, and a Democratic Congress is not going to be left behind. You know, sure. The Democrats are not going to be the party of "We like your kids getting snatched from Sears,"
no.
which was the previous slogan. That's why Adlai Stevenson lost.
Yeah, that's right. How is Carter going to run again?
In 1984, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children is created by Congress. It's a nonprofit devoted just to, you know, and they pour tens of millions of dollars into this agency to raise awareness of protecting our kids.
You're blowing my mind right now.
None of this existed before 1984. Whoa, a little ominous there. 1984, am I right?
Oh.
The hippies were right.
Yeah, double plus bad.
The old think is let your kids ride bikes. A rash of state laws start to appear that are designed as memorial laws for these kids. Like, this is Douglas's law, you know?
Oh, I'm kind of getting mad now.
About how this is getting weaponized? This
terrible weaponization of it. Yeah.
These are family tragedies.
Because this is what ends up with the preschool.
The satanic panic.
Yeah, all of this.
That's exactly where that comes. And obviously, like, I can't blame the crusading parents who are appearing in front of state legislatures and saying, you know, how did we let down Elaine, you know, like,
yeah.
And so but the laws are a little bit dubious as we'll see. You know, you got the ACLU saying, well, some of these are things you can't actually do. And this is the environment that leads to, what are we, like an hour in?
No, half hour.
Kids on milk cartons.
Oh, kids on milk cartons.
Suddenly, why are kids on milk cartons of all places? It's in hindsight, it seems a little inexplicable.
It's so funny because do you remember in the 70s, you may or may not, in the 70s, the milk carton boat race on Green Lake?
Yeah. Don't they still do it?
Do they still do it?
Or maybe they don't.
Well, there aren't any milk cartons anymore.
I assume they would just use those big plastic gallons.
The big plastic ones. But in the old days, yeah. So those of you playing along at home, whatever bingo card this is, they actually would make rafts out of paper milk cartons, used milk cartons, and race across Green Lake.
And sink,
because it's a terrible thing to make a boat of. But if, you know, the race was who can go the furthest before their boat sinks.
That's a good metaphor for life. You're like, nobody actually wins. Nobody makes it to the other side.
So when I first saw the title of today's show, I was like, oh, kids on milk cartons. This is going to be like some crazy like milk carton thing. Race.
Soapbox derby. No, it's much bleaker than that. I apologize. Dear. I hope everyone, but you do remember the specter of a milk carton, one of those wax paper milk cartons on your breakfast table
with
two kind of kids in braces grinning out at you, not knowing that they're a year away from disappearing with their stepdad or whatever.
And we were the kids that were staring at the faces of those kids and wondering,
am
what
I
if,
next?
Yeah. What if that were, where are they now? Are they living? Are they going to an elementary school?
Because sometimes the dates were just heartbreakingly old. It would be like missing since, and then you'd see some year that was 7 years ago. Like, well, that kid does not look like that anymore.
Right.
But it's weird, right? That they were on milk cartons. You have to imagine, this is a much slower news time with a much slower news cycle, fewer, you know, less crowded media landscape. How do you get urgent news in front of the most eyeballs? You know, what's a delivery mechanism that actually reaches people?
And, and milk expires.
Milk expires, and dairies are regional, you know? So here's a regional concern. The kid that went missing from the next town, hey, the local dairy can get it in front of, you know, 100,000 breakfast tables in 2 weeks.
Is that how it worked?
They used to have ads. They used to sell ad space. Milk cartons would have ads, and they decided to be do-gooders. And I think if you're being cynical, they were also maybe claiming some kind of tax write-off because they were supporting this worthy cause and this nonprofit.
Listen, we are not cynical on this program.
Right. I'm sure they also wanted the kids to come home.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But I
sure,
think in
sure.
hindsight, a lot of the writing on this has said, also, they were probably getting, their accounting department's probably very happy about this arrangement. John, this is kind of exciting.
Oh.
We don't normally.
that's quite a
promise.
Yeah.
Well, what? I'm going to live up to it. Now, we don't often record ads for books on Omnibus, but what better product to put on a podcast than a book? It's like a podcast you can read.
It's the most exciting thing. And, you know, I think as podcast advertising goes through its 11th identity crisis, it's starting to dawn on me that the familiar podcast friends that we have that advertise on the show, there are a lot of other people and things, businesses that could advertise on podcasts and reach, in our case, a global audience.
An extremely like-minded audience. It's actually an omnibus listener. Dr. Brian Villmore is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Las Vegas, a paleoanthropologist, and he has a new book out from Cambridge University Press.
The Evolution of Everything.
That he thought would be of interest to omnibus listeners. And I was paging through it today, and I agree. This is right down the plate for someone who listens to omnibus, because like we do on the show, except with the benefit of his actual authority and scholarship, he's kind of taking a big picture look at human history.
I just flipped open to just a random page.
Okay.
And here he is comparing the planned construction of a cathedral to a termite mound. And there's a, you know, like graphic comparison here. And that couldn't be more up our alley.
It's extremely flattering to the termite.
Well, what the people have done here is they've covered the termite mound in plaster and then hosed off the dirt, so that what you have is a plaster like portrait of the inside of a termite mound. Pretty smart.
It's one of these big history.
Just like a cathedral.
Exactly. It's a cathedral to termites. It's one of these big history nonfiction books that encompasses world history, but it begins with the Big Bang Theory. Ooh, and page, what page are you on there, John? Page 330, is that right?
Let's see.
Appears to be very compatible with Marxism.
That's right. 330 begins the Marxism component of chapter 21, economics.
But so there's chapters on trade, on exploration, on all these different phases of human behavior and world history, but like through the big lens of how it fits into the universe, our evolution as a species, our evolution as a planet. It's structured kind of like a freshman level college textbook, but you know, with all the scientific rigor of Dr. Villmore's background, but it's written to be read as a popular science book. So it's not for subject area experts. It's very easy to read.
If you read one book this year, I would read The Evolution of Everything, The Patterns and Causes of Big History by Dr. Brian Villmore.
An omnibus fan who has a good enough sense of our listenership to think it might be of interest to you as well.
Chapter 8, The Cambrian Explosion.
It's out.
Not an explosion.
I'm having an explosion of excitement right now.
It's an explosion.
It is an explosion of species.
Yes.
You can buy it anywhere books are sold. It's out from Cambridge University Press now. And if you want to find out more about it, you can go to brianvillmore.com. That's Brian, VillMoare. .com. John and I recommend it. Omnibus approved. The thing that kicked off the milk carton phenomenon was a specific incident in Des Moines. In 1982, and then later, 2 years later in 1984, in nearly identical incidents, in the early morning hours, two boys, 2 years apart, who were out delivering the Des Moines Register.
There's your first mistake.
Having a paper route? That's what we're celebrating about this simpler time. Kids could.
Did you ever have a paper route?
I helped my aunt and uncle with theirs, but that was weird. A weird kind of family endeavor. It wasn't a kid out on a bike.
Yeah,
they would go out in the minivan every day just to make a little extra scratch for a Disneyland trip or something.
That is the most Mormon thing I've ever heard you say.
They would always sing together. It was a South Park episode. So these two kids go missing, and it leads to a local panic. It's in a very nice, sheltered suburb of Des Moines. And so the subtext of all this becomes, well, we're the good ones. I mean, obviously this can happen to those people in those cities.
Sure.
But, you know, and nobody says, but we're white.
Right.
But that's kind of the subtext. You know, like we pay property taxes for the good part of town where the criminals and they would actually say terrorists. And terrorism came to Des Moines.
But this is something where the idea is that a monster lives among us?
Yeah, the mom actually, the kid's name was, let me see, Johnny, not Bosch, Johnny Gosh. That seems
Johnny
fake.
Gosh.
I'm just going to invent a kid named Johnny Gosh. Oh, it is Johnny Gosh. How is that the real name?
I don't know. That's a great character name, though. Too bad it's taken.
It's got a C, so it's not like Bagosh. But Johnny Gosh's mom is apparently... I don't want to say she's a kook, but she's certainly driven to extremis, not de minimis, but in extremis by the kidnapping of her
son. I see that now. You're saying that it was a panic, but these two kidnappings happened 2 years apart. So a slow panic, a rising panic.
Well, the second incident is definitely something's gone wrong in our safe, protected Lily White area.
One kid could have fallen down a manhole, but two kids?
Two kids is clearly a manhole clown. Yeah. Noreen actually testifies to Congress to the effect that it's an organized pedophilia ring across America. And have you heard? Yeah, this is the early awakenings of QAnon. And then in fact, the National American Man Boy Love Association, admits to, so there's this whole homosexualist axis that is grabbing your kids. She later says, I mean, after the second kidnapping, a little boy named Martin, I think, after the second kid goes missing 2 years later, golly gee, she says that, oh yeah, that's exactly what happened. My private investigator that I hired after the police botched this told me that a second kid would go missing, and it would also be the third weekend in August, and it would be an early morning paper out. So she's a full-on conspiracy theorist.
But this is the dawn of profiling, too. So that's got to be exciting for everybody.
Yeah, well, keep an eye out. You know, there's no next door yet, but it really is the early days of who's wearing the wrong hoodie on your street.
Yeah.
Do you know that kid? And Reagan makes a campaign stop in 1984. He comes through Iowa and in Cedar Rapids gives a speech about the good-hearted people who broke the sod of this prairie and how they now have to face all these interlopers, you know what I mean? Not the good Scandinavian stock. And, it really was kind of they're coming for your kids and we got to get tough on crime. The same month that Reagan gives that speech in Cedar Rapids, a local dairy, Anderson Erickson, makes this pivotal choice, inspired perhaps by the Gipper.
Uh-huh.
We need to root out this new evil among us. We got to find Johnny and these other two subsequent kids that may or may not be related. And they start putting photos of these kids on their milk cartons every morning. And so you have this.
So it's a virtue signal a little bit.
Yeah. And a tax write-off and a virtue signal. I'm sure it's a guy who is watching the nightly news, because everyone would watch the nightly news and people would get very involved in, I mean, it's kind of the beginning of true crime fascination is these, moms saying this, we didn't get the real killer. And they're Adam, people watching this TV movie about getting this voyeuristic thrill of, well, boy, what did happen? We still don't know. That led to a million podcasts.
At this point, were there instances where kids had been rescued by public, by phone poll posters and stuff had a quick response actually saved any missing kids?
As far as I can tell, the only real cultural footprint of that starts with milk cartons.
Okay.
Milk cartons are the first case where news stories start to get written, because hundreds of dairies immediately follow suit all over the country. The idea spreads, and you start to see news stories of this kid was reunited with his parents after, in this grocery store, this woman spotted this carton of milk and said, well, that kid looks just like Daisy. Her name's not Daisy, but that's Daisy from my daughter's school. And in one very famous case, a girl named Bonnie Lohman actually recognized herself on a milk carton and found out that daddy wasn't actually daddy. It was her abductor stepfather or something.
Whoa. Because she'd been kidnapped at a young enough
years later, she sees her own baby picture and her dad doesn't want to freak out. He's like, oh yeah, weird. Well, let's clip that and you can keep it. But it turns out to be his undoing.
Wow.
And so these stories start to be written and it starts to become, the idea begins to spread that this works, if you can just get the picture in front of enough people.
I wonder, a lot of the time you look back at something like this and it turns out that there was a milk producers convention.
It's like one.
Like 10 days after the first one, and they're all standing around in the lobby, and 2 weeks later, every milk carton in the country.
I wonder if there was some, you mentioned virtue signaling. I wonder if there is some unwillingness to be the last dairy that's still running ads.
Right.
In a world where everybody else is doing this urgent public good.
If you think of all the dairies in America, they're all called Erickson, Anderson, Svensson.
By law.
So it might have just been like a Norwegian Brotherhood meeting.
It's funny that it's milk, right? Because what could be more wholesome than, America's Dairyland providing you with this wholesome, you know, kids are told how important milk is to their safe upbringing. And so it goes with the brand. If the family's all together at breakfast and, you know, it's the perfect branding for this effort. But that doesn't mean the pictures don't start to appear everywhere. Do you remember the spread of missing kid pictures? Milk cartons were such a success that, you know, you couldn't go through your day without seeing every public space being filled with photos of 7-year-olds missing.
What's crazy, don't let me derail you.
No, no.
Reagan gave that speech in Cedar Rapids?
Yeah.
Cedar Rapids is the home of Cap'n Crunch cereal.
Oh,
the
right.
Quaker Oats plant is in Cedar Rapids.
So that
this is like a big cereal milk thing.
Big Crunch wants you to use more milk.
It's Big Crunch.
They, but it wasn't, so as I'm saying, it wasn't just milk cartons. You know, you started to see them on, you know, the paper bags you'd get at the supermarket would have two kids, pizza boxes, you know, any place that, you know, phone books would have space for it. I think sometimes your utility bill
had a little kid.
Would have kids on the back, you know.
This is before I was paying utility bills.
Or even like a toll ticket on the turnpike. You know, you get your ticket and then it's like, but also keep an eye out for Sam, you know. You have to wonder if there was, and I think people at the time said, is there not just a, you know, beyond the hysteria aspect that comes to mind now for us, is there a numbing effect?
Sure.
Of just like, yeah, six kids. More missing kids. There's always missing kids, you know. You no longer are we shocked by, you know, we can't be living in a society that allows this.
But the numbing effect does have an effect on your imagination, because at a certain point when you're like, there's 800,000 missing kids in America.
Every year.
What you're imagining is like sex dungeons and children being ground into hamburger.
Because where could they be going?
Yeah.
Right? Like imagine the football stadiums you would need to hold 800,000 missing kids.
And so it becomes a kind of like a pernicious sense that the world is absolutely full of torture caverns and monsters everywhere.
And you believe the report that there might be one under this pizza parlor.
Right.
Or in this daycare, you know, because
Hillary Clinton may be eating one right now.
They've got to be somewhere, right?
But you know, you think about QAnon, sure, but just this sense we all have that the world is crazy and that people are evil, awful.
It leads to every kind of conspiracy theory and cynicism.
This low-lying hum of feeling like, kids go missing all the time.
It's a fallen world.
Yeah. And none of those, wow.
I mean, it's...
This is why I was so shocked when we started this episode.
And it turns out it might be 50 kids a year.
It's just getting more and more... I'm just thinking about all the ramifications of that numb feeling that this is no longer something we're worried about because
it's clearly out of control.
And that's why I don't let my daughter walk a mile, because of the white vans and sex dungeons. And
it means the free range activists have to actively say, not just, you know what, this is a very small risk, because that's not going to convince people with this kind of mindset. Yeah. It's a small risk, lady. You have to actively say, and there's trade-offs. You're making paranoid kids. You're making kids that can't navigate the world, you know.
But also, when you have a dispute with somebody, you just, I mean, when I think of my own neighborhood, I'm like, well, you know, one out of five of these people probably is killing cats.
And it becomes self-fulfilling, because then every traffic accident or road rage incident does end in somebody pulling a gun, because everyone's thinking, yeah, this guy's probably going to pull a gun. The world's full of irredeemable sociopaths.
What is there's got to be a name for this, where something starts with great intentions, because there's no, at the beginning, the people there at Big Oats.
Yeah. They weren't like,
they're not like,
this will make everyone paranoid and bummed.
But then, and I'm sure there are people looking back who are like, yeah, it was always a Republican plot to make us hate each other, but it clearly wasn't.
It just seems like it's an organic, everyone's trying their best at every moment for what seems to be an inarguable proposition that fewer kids should get kidnapped.
And then down the line, it has created, at some level, is a part of creating a divided society.
Speaking of phenomena that are runaway trains, the apotheosis of this
runaway
kind of...
Runaway train never coming back.
Do you remember the video?
Going to take it with the one way.
Apparently, you don't remember the words.
It's black and white.
Or you're singing a reggae cover of it?
With a somewhere. All I remember is Winona Ryder was going out with that dreadlock ding-a-ling, and I was like, Winona, I'm right here.
Soul Asylum was a Minneapolis kind of punk band of the Replacements mold.
Yeah, they were pretty good. That first couple of Soul Asylum records, pretty good.
But they had kind of flamed out a bit, and it seemed like their career might be over.
Justifiable.
And then they had a crossover power ballad hit in 1993 with Runaway Train. I think Dave Perner wrote the song about his...
That's him.
He wrote the song about his... song about his dreadlocks.
That's my Winona stealing dreadlock.
If not
nemesis.
For him, you feel like you were number two? Show us your Winona Forever tattoo.
No, I got it. I got it traced over with some checkered flags.
You can't put wino. Yeah, you have to put something else. Yeah. No forever.
No wino.
Win forever.
Wins. So wait a minute. Yeah, I.
So David Perner had written the song about his depression. The train is just a metaphor for his mental health struggles.
Yeah, his runaway train.
But they hired this British guy named Tony Kaye to direct the video, and. I think he's a deeply eccentric guy, given what later happened with him, his direction of the movie American History X, which effectively was so eccentric that it ended his career. That's worth a Google.
That's a really good movie, I think.
It is, but it was almost credited to Humpty Dumpty because he tried to take his name off it.
Oh, no. Now, wait. So this David Perner thing, this Runaway Train thing, I get a sense of what you're about to tell me.
Yeah.
But this was this is exactly right in the heart of the period where I was – really on drugs and not part of the culture. I have never seen what you're leading up to, which is a music video for this song, and you're about to tell me that
you were watching so much less VH1 than I was in 1993.
I never any of the movies that came out between 1990 and 1995. You can pretty much rest assured I never saw them. I never saw Reality Bites, and that was like basically a film about.
A fun podcast idea. I mean, it's not fun because it involves struggles with addiction, but a fun podcast idea would be to take someone with 5 to 10 missing years. Let's take Ringo Starr, who probably does not remember anything between
72 and 78.
And every day you just kind of blow his mind with a new thing. Like, let me show you a show called Dukes of Hazzard, Ringo.
Ringo, have you ever
heard
love this. ELO? You probably have.
You don't remember.
So you're about to tell me about Runaway Train.
Tony Kaye fixated on the word runaway in the title and thought, yes, I too, Dave Perner, am obsessed with the plight of runaways, you know, these sad kids on street corners. We must bring awareness to this. And Dave Perner's like, I'm going to go to dinner with Winona Ryder. And so Kaye's idea was to kind of show this arty black and white kind of kids in trouble kind of stuff. Sprinkled with actual stills. I think typically during the chorus, stills of missing kids with their names and then the heartbreaking amount of time that they've been gone, you know, ran away and, you know, missing since 1986, missing since 1985.
But these are runaways, which are also, I mean, it's like Joan Jett and Susie Quattro.
Okay. That's the thing. Like the name of the nonprofit is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Missing for all reasons. So America has kind of conflated the idea of...
Well, and exploited implies teenage prostitution,
right.
Which is a hell of a thing.
As if every runaway kid is now getting trafficked in some way or... You know, basically the idea is that missing kids are missing kids, and I guess to some degree there's some sense to this. It doesn't matter if they're on a street corner in Portland or if they're, chained in a basement in Biloxi, like... That's not the system let them down. Where, you know, they need to be with their families. Biloxi.
But there is a difference between that and being with their father in Saudi Arabia.
There is a huge difference. And what happened was the video came out and with 36 missing US kids, they made different versions for different markets. So on MTV Europe or MTV Australia, it would have missing kids from that market. Because the idea is, what a valuable public service we Soul Asylum are providing.
Oh my God, I'm really mad at Dave Perner. I mean, I already was, but...
I'm sure Dave Perner's lovely.
Yeah, I bet he is. I bet he's a nice guy.
Tony Kaye, you don't know any of those guys. You never hung out with Soul Asylum.
I was briefly in college radio in the late 80s, and we played that Clam Dippin' of Their Delights, and it was... I thought I was really into them and the Buck Pets.
But by Gravediggers Union, they sold out, and
yeah,
you were like,
man.
You were like, what if needle drugs?
This is what's wrong with the world.
Tony Kaye, the director, started to claim in interviews that 21 of these kids had been reunited with their families thanks to the heroic music video he'd put on.
Humpty Dumpty's MTV. Taking credit for all this?
The future Humpty Dumpty. And the band, of course, starts to parrot in interviews because they don't know. So somebody will ask them, they would get asked about this for decades. Like, hey, what about that... Runaway, Runaway Train video, and they'd be like, yeah, I hear a lot of kids found their homes. That's,
am I going to have to watch this video this afternoon? I really didn't start today thinking this was going to happen.
It had never occurred to me that you had not seen the Runaway Train video. A recent article kind of made me think about this. Nick Kepler wrote for Slate where he tracked down as many of the kids he could find. Because you can find a list. You know, actually, we now know that four of them have since died. Such and such, many of them are still missing. But, you know, a few dozen of them have turned up, and he tracked down as many as he could. And their stories were interesting because it really made you rethink the, at all costs, society must get these kids back to their custodial parents. Because as you...
Because the kids were like, I really hate my parents.
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody who knows anything about runaways, all these kids had stories of, you know, there's a lot of mental health issues. There's bullying. There's all kinds, you know, unmedicated stuff. But there's also a ton of... sexual assault by my stepfather, you know, my toxic mother used to lock me outside when it was 20 below, you know, the kind of thing where sending these kids home is as indefensible as a, you know, a street corner in Portland or the Bay Area. And in many cases, it seems like these kids had stories of resourcefulness. Like I was only 16, but I knew I needed to get out. I had to, you know, in two more years, I could run out the clock.
Right.
And
so I got a job somewhere.
Exactly. I got a fake ID. I'm working at Walmart. I couch surfed and I moved to a city where I knew one person and couch surfed for a few, you know, and a lot of these stories are, you know, and some of them do have angles of, and I ran into this guy who probably thought I was 18 or, you know, yeah. Obviously it's not an easy life for a kid on the streets, but many of these stories, it was so clear that, you know, these kids had done kind of what they had to do just to survive. And here's Dave Perner trying to get them back with their molester stepfather.
What's funny is that the culture that I was in during these years, the alternative rock culture,
you knew these kids,
knew a lot of people that had exactly this story.
There was a documentary about the Seattle runaways.
Like I got out of the house at 14, and I've been living on my own ever since. And a lot of them, like, really not just resourceful, but like, I don't know. I mean, I'm friends with a lot of them to this day, and I don't think you would say like, oh, they were well.
It wasn't something to celebrate.
No, but when they would talk about their childhood home, you're like, well, that's worse.
That would be worse.
And
clearly, the system had already let them down on a couple levels.
Being in an orphanage or a reform school also worse. And so, but you know, alternative culture then, there were a lot of warehouses full of artists, and one more kid kind of didn't.
It was a softer landing pad.
Yeah, or at least there was a kind of communal punk rock underground that was kid friendly.
And you love punk rock.
I'm number one
fan.
Number one fan.
You got that big foam finger that says number one punk rock fan.
But I think it's so funny that we think about it differently in different contexts, because I know a lot of runaways that are now full-grown adults with kids and families, that you think of their runaway teenage years as like, oh yeah, that was.
And yet if one of our kids or one of their friends were to run away,
it would just be the end of the world, right? And I'm also looking at milk carton kids probably in that same era and going like, oh man, that kid is tied up in a dungeon somewhere. It's like, no, they're the exact same age as your buddy over here that's like in a really good band now.
I feel like we think about parenting differently now. Have you noticed this as well? This idea that, you know, I think 30 years ago when this Runaway Train comes out, there's just this general assumption that the kids are screw ups and need their reliable parents.
Right.
And I think today we're much more aware of the narrative of, well, no, my mom was a terrible narcissist actually. And, getting away from that was like the number one most urgent thing I needed to do. You know, we kind of understand now that when parents have these sob stories about how none of their kids will talk to them, we no longer think, well, those ungrateful kids. We kind of think, what did you do to those kids?
One of my dad's best friends grew up in an orphanage, proper like Montana,
wow,
unheated orphanage in the 1930s. And late 20s and 30s, and he would tell stories. He ended up becoming a judge. He would tell stories about all the amazing times he had with his four brothers in this like little orphan Annie.
It was just kind of a Mark Twain. Yeah,
it was, you know, Annie. Yeah, nobody was watching them, and they were home on the range.
Hijinks. I mean, obviously there were.
I don't think that exists anymore.
We talked about That's something else we should have. I mean, did the institutions get worse, or are we just?
Yeah.
Okay, I assume so. you know, we've talked about what some of the downsides of this culture were. You know, it made the parents paranoid, and as you point out, just prone to all kinds of catastrophic thinking about the world.
That's us.
It made kids probably neurotic, just the specter of danger everywhere. And there's some research showing that the more sheltered a kid is, the more prejudiced they become, because they just believe the small number of data points they've been given. They can't actually navigate in the world and see actually sometimes this is good and sometimes it's bad, and here's how you navigate it.
And even if all the statistics are like, there really aren't that many black serial killers, the ones that we find typically are suburban white youth pastors.
Yeah.
But if you're going to be xenophobic, let's have the xenophobia, you know, it kind of reinforces your other xenophobias. Like, I can only imagine that it plays into like, oh, and we also don't like.
Well, think about how many of those milk carton kids were white. I mean, statistically, more kids were going missing in disadvantaged communities.
Right.
But the ones that showed up on the milk cartons were the winsome white kids. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole
The Anderson Svensson.
Erickson Bakery. There's an Eddie Griffin comedy routine about this that's pretty famous about like why all those kids were white and what that kind of tells you about America.
The milk was also white.
Maybe chocolate milk should have had more diverse photos. I'm just spitballing
here. You're going to get canceled for that.
Possibly. But milk carton kids are obsolete today, not because nobody's getting kidnapped by their mom's ex or whatever.
Because nobody ever was.
But because of Amber Alerts.
Of course.
The media landscape changed, and now there is a more real-time way than a box of milk to tell people, keep an eye out for this kid that just vanished from school pickup or from Target.
You know who figured out how to opt out from Amber Alerts on his phone?
This guy.
That's right.
Who has two thumbs and
no thanks.
Well, that was kind of the early worry about Amber Alerts. Like, is it going to be numbing the way milk cartons were? You know, if you keep getting these push notifications. But in fact, they seem to be working. In the year 2014, this is, almost 20 years into the Amber Alert era, 186 Amber Alerts were issued in America, and 154 of them led to a positive ID.
You're kidding.
No, so Amber Alert nearly always successful.
How? Oh, because it's so instantaneous. It's like, this kid's been missing for 2 hours, and he was last seen in a red car.
Because you can get there before the
kidding.
You know, the guy skips town, or the kid goes in the river or the dumpster.
Who invented the Amber Alert?
It was Bob Amber. It wasn't originally a phone push notification.
It wasn't named after a girl named Amber.
It was named after a missing girl. Yeah,
it was.
It's also a backronym. Like, it's also the alert to meteorically banish real evil or something.
But I always thought it just was like an amber police light, like a spinning.
Like, that's the color of awareness.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was actually named after her name.
I think it was a famous case, and then they re-engineered the acronym the way Congress always does.
Well done, Congress.
This was originally, it was just the emergency broadcast system. You know, we have this tone that will tell you when a weather system's coming in.
No, it was always about the nukes.
But when it gets used, it never got used for nukes yet, aspirational. But it did get used for, look out, there's a flood, the river's flooding, or, you know, whatever.
For instance, a Western state hurricane.
For example, hypothetically, and they just started using that same tone for, hey, keep an eye out for this late model, whatever, with this a kid and that totally worked. And of course, today, many of these kids have phones, which means they're so much harder. I'm sure you find, John, so much harder to kidnap.
Well, the first thing I do is grab their phone.
You got to grab the phone.
Well,
first.
No, this is again one of the arguments that we have for our daughter is right at the age where. It's like, do we...
Last kid without a phone,
yeah,
right?
Do we or do we not give her a phone? And we really don't want to. Every grown-up I've talked to, including you, has said, yeah...
It will break their little brains. Yeah, have fun!
Giving the teen a phone was something we wish we didn't have to do. And so we're like, well, we're the exactly the kind of parents that wouldn't. And yet, what do we do?
Just get her a pager.
A pager.
Do they still make pagers?
She's not a weed dealer.
Just to close the circle on some of this stuff, the Adam Walsh case was closed in 2008.
Closed just like presumed dead?
No one was in the Walsh case. Actually, remains were found in a nearby canal fairly quickly. I think less than a week later. You can You can look up the details. It's pretty ugly. But
and confirmed that it was him?
It was him, yeah. And I guess a drifter named Otis Toole, that almost seems impossible to believe, seems like he confessed to it, but then he's a guy who confesses to a lot of stuff. And
We don't talk about drifters anymore.
There was blood in his car, but the police department lost all the evidence. It's just kind of your classic American Keystone Cop story. But the interesting part...
he looks like a creep, Otis Toole.
Wow, that's... See, I'm glad you weren't the... Oh, wait, you were the generation raised more prejudiced, John. But Adam's dad, played by Daniel Travanti in the show, decided to become a full-time advocate for victims' rights. And as many will know, he is John Walsh, who created America's Most Wanted.
Is that the guy?
Yeah. And that was his... That was how he got into the... How he got, motivated, how he became an activist. In 2012, a New Jersey bodega worker named Pablo Hernandez confessed to killing Ayton Pates in Soho in 1979. Apparently, it had been he had just been telling family and parishioners for decades that he had been done it. He was kind of a oddball, arguable whether he had the emotional, the intellectual wherewithal to even face trial. And finally, somebody went to the cops and said, this guy's been telling people for years that he kidnapped that famous kid. And he received life in prison in 2017. In Iowa, the Gosch and Martin cases are still unsolved. But to this day, despite the actual statistics, 28% of American parents tell Pew they are extremely worried about abductions. And this is the hysteria that, as we've said, led to the satanic panic of the 80s. QAnon conspiracy theories today, just credulous parents believing any wild accusation because to not take it seriously might endanger their children. And
I wonder how many of our listeners to this program have been like shocked by you and me kind of laughing throughout the episode.
We're not laughing.
Not laughing at all of the missing kids, but I guess we are lighthearted take on it.
And we're downplaying the, we're downplaying the seriousness of it just because statistically it is extremely rare.
And the
cases are horrific.
Right.
They just appear to not be something to build a parenting strategy or a society around.
Right. A social concept.
Social contract around.
But yeah, this is another building block in this world that we are trying to document where a lot of the conventional wisdom about how bad people are to each other just doesn't hold water.
And there's, another example of the knock-on effect of this is a writer named Paul Renfrew a few years ago wrote a book about America's struggle with mass incarceration, and he draws the line directly between 1980s era politicians, the Reagan administration, for example, being able to weaponize these high profile cases, scare people into vastly changing a system and passing all these new tough on crime laws, memorial laws, each of which was extremely well intended. And, only in aggregate do you see the pattern of suddenly America has a different opinion of. If you'd ask somebody back then, hey, should there be this many million people in jail? People would say, no, there's not that many million bad people in America. And this was kind of the tipping point that made it acceptable in America to believe, yeah, I think tens of millions of people could be in jail, especially if they're not my color or complexion. Like that, I'm okay with that. I don't know if you could have gotten there without threatening a bunch of people, people feeling like their children were threatened.
Right.
There
shouldn't be that many people in jail, but the bad people should be in worse jail.
We need fewer but worse jails.
Fewer jails, but make them worse.
I love this radical centrist approach. What's the name of your political party? Fewer worse jails.
Fewer but worse jails.
All right. Vote John Roderick.
And that concludes Kids on Milk Cartons. Entry 686.DE2407. Certificate number 25468.
Are you seeing these numbers for the first time?
I'm seeing.
What's this one with two circles on top of each other?
Having a stroke. 25 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are a missing child, or in the unlikely event that you are drinking milk,
knock twice on the heater pipes and someone will come.
Make sure to go on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and write a very, very panicky post about Pizzagate. Is that still a thing? It is. Yeah, there's a whole
there's some offshoot of it.
There's a whole part of America that really still believes that
Washington deep staters are
harvesting
the glands of children.
The glands because of adrenochrome?
You wouldn't want to harvest an adult's glands. You know, that's years of hard living.
This is really like a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas plot point.
Yes.
Adrenochrome, but it's except monkey
these are,
adrenochrome.
These are people believing it without drugs.
As far as we know. Go on the Omnibus Facebook group. You can, I'm going to take Twitter out of this because A, Twitter doesn't exist anymore. And B, I don't want to direct anyone there. Do you concur?
Yeah.
All right. We're not going to talk about Twitter
anymore. As
we
record this, Elon just said you can't block people anymore.
I saw that.
That seems great.
Let's all agree that we're not going to go there anymore.
I'm sure it's a coincidence that he is like the most blocked person on Twitter. I'm sure that had nothing to do with the policy change.
Do you continue to post there?
No. I mean, maybe careerist stuff, but probably even not that for long.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. What are the other? I have
Threads,
so little interest.
Oh, Mastodon, Threads, Blue Mastodon, Sky.
Blue Sky. Go to those places, I guess. Don't. Just get off of it all. Just come here to Omnibus. But if you want to hang out with people, go to Facebook and look for Futurelings. I'm at John Roderick. Ken is at Kent Jennings. You can email us. Maybe what we should do is start just publishing all the emails we get on our Patreon page.
What if? Yeah.
So it's just like, it's not exactly a message board. It's just kind of like
classified ads or something.
Yeah, you kind of get your email posted as long as it has no swears.
I like it.
Go to email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com or go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/... Omnibus Project, and look for exciting new developments where we just start publishing really everything we get, because we already take pictures of all the mail that we get. Our show notes are available there.
If you're ever flummoxed by us just describing some weird item we got in the mail, worry no longer.
You know what we should do? We should put up a map of the Northwest and a map of Seattle neighborhoods, and then put little pins. No, it can be a fan thing.
When John says 183rd and Dayton, I think somebody is maybe keeping a map of geotagging Omnibus.
Yeah, if somebody's geotagging all the Northwest locate all the street corners that Ken and I mentioned, that'd be a fun thing to spread around. But go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and joining our Patreon at any membership level gives you access to this, what's already an incredible database of addenda show where we talk about all the letters we get from angry people who say, I was a missing kid wasn't fun.
Almost 50 of these.
We have 50 episodes.
Almost. We're getting there. We're in the 40s somewhere.
And they're great. They're really fun. We're going to actually record one this afternoon.
Probably better than this show.
No, every show is equally good.
No, the one you have to pay for is a little better.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Why would the free ones be better? You can't just give away the milk.
But we really do appreciate your membership over there. And it really is kind of the future of media to support the things that you love with what ends up being a nominal contribution.
Or they don't exist.
You can send us actual mail, which we will then photograph and put up for our Patreon subscribers at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
I got a raft of postcards last time I checked the mail. Do you know someone...
Like a milk carton raft?
Yeah. And we made a raft out of postcards and it sunk. Do you know someone named Rye from Kirkland? Because he just went to Japan and he sent you postcards at every stage.
He sent them to me?
John Roderick, care of Omnibus.
What the what? But what? What's going on, Rye?
The messages include the following. Howdy from Tokyo.
Howdy.
Thank you for being you. I bought more postcards and stamps, so here is another. Do you like the Moomins?
I do. Who doesn't like a Moomin?
The Japanese do too, except they're not. They're like, Finnish or something.
Oh, that's right.
Sweeto-Finnish. And then his final note, I can't wait to get home. Did he get home? We may never know.
So Rye, and these are messages that are that short.
Yes.
They're directed to me.
He just wants you to know he was in Japan.
Do we know that Rye is a he?
And thought of you. Oh, I guess it's true. I assumed it was short for Ryan, but I guess there are women named Ryan. It could be a they.
I bought more postcards and stamps. Rye Jones.
We occasionally hear from the Center for Land Use Interpretation. They want us to know they have a new exhibit at their Culver City, California center about Harper's Ferry and the interpretive infrastructure of the National Park Service.
I like it.
So if you're interested in National Park infrastructure, get thee to 9331 Venice Boulevard and go to the Museum of Jurassic Technology down the street while you're there. It's crazy. Let me see. Our correspondent Sparky sends us something from the Clink, Eastern State Penitentiary.
Ooh. Yeesh.
He is not, in fact, interned there. He visited it. He says, apart from the physical legacy of the prison, they do an excellent job of laying out the history and flaws of the U.S. prison industrial complex. That's on topic for this week's entry.
You know, Rye is a guitar player.
Rye Cooter?
No, Rye Cooter is a guitar player, but Rye Jones is also. I know who this is.
Do you think all guitar players are named Rye on some level?
You know, the
Can
last...
Can you name one that's not? Keith Rye Church.
It's not coming to mind. The last alcohol I ever drank was rye.
Is that true?
Before I got sober, it was rye that put me over the edge.
You're like, no way. Like, I thought all booze was... would do it for me, but I finally found one bad enough to get me to quit.
Yeah, I drank rye, I got into a gun battle, and then it was over.
That's what they should tell, like, people fighting addiction. Just
drink rye.
Just drink rye, and
one time.
You'll be done. And then Gabe and Haley sent us a note from...
Gabe and Haley.
Cape Hatteras National. Why are you saying Gabe and Haley?
I just like it. It just rolls off the tongue, Gabe and Haley.
Well, I'm glad because they got married.
Gabe and Haley got married?
They better stay together.
Oh, Gabe and Haley.
Okay, this is funny. It's written in the voice of Gabe, but apparently Haley wrote it because she has better handwriting. And it's true. It is beautiful little... It looks like she's lettering a cute newspaper comic strip or something.
I want you to right now just spend like 2 seconds trying to get inside the relationship of Gabe and Haley.
Where he makes her write his postcards?
Well, no, where Gabe is like, hey, let's write a postcard. And Haley's like, I'll write it.
Okay.
All right, what are we going to say? And Haley's like, I got the penmanship. You've got the story.
It's the 1960s Don Draper dream. Marry your stenographer.
This is so beautiful.
They got married in June at this very lighthouse. They took a tour before the ceremony, and apparently they thought of us because the park ranger told us. Of course, the lighthouse has a Fresnel lens. The original 1871 lens still in use today.
I thought you were going to say that it had seven sides.
Wait, this is funny. My wife and I love lighthouses and would love to hear an episode on the wild history of Outer Banks lighthouses, especially the moving of Cape Hatteras. I don't want to start their marriage off on a bad note, but Gabe and Haley.
Gabe and Haley, go back and listen to her.
Didn't we do that show like 2 years ago? Like,
maybe they came into Omnibus fairly recently and they're not one of these, like, we're going to go back and listen to everything.
But you think it would be like during their courtship, if this is their very favorite thing. At what point did they not notice that the podcast they listened to actually covered their favorite topic?
Boy, I don't know. You know, you and I both have trouble sometimes remembering all of the Omnibus episodes.
It's true. What was it the other day? You were like, I'm going to do a show on this. And I was like, that's great. You did it 3 years ago. I can't remember what it was.
But it's funny because, you know, we started this show because we are constantly doing these deep dives. And so there are often shows where we're doing a show about something we've thought a lot about over the years. And that was one where I was like, oh yeah, I've been thinking about this for a long time.
Yes, you have. Gabe and Haley, in order to celebrate your marriage, we did not actually send you anything, but we went back in time and recorded a podcast episode just for you. Please check the archives.
Time is a flat circle.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.